Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean, and the show is called Getting It Done. And for the last 2 weeks, we have been presenting information on different institutions in our society and how they have treated black people. We first start off with Sally. That's Sally Hemings. And then we went on to Soldier on the Truth. We did one program with the legends and black athletes. And then Harriet Tubman. We have decided, why should we wait until February to study about different institutions and what is called today institutional racism? Today we are getting to check out one of the world's greatest tap dancer and movie stars. So we will be looking at the entertainment institution and how it, back in the day, treated African Americans, and in some cases still today. So let's take a look and listen to what's being stated here.
School in the first grade and did not learn to read or write. Instead, He spent his days in the local marketplace working odd jobs like shelling peas, shining shoes, and dancing in the streets for pennies. In the evenings, Bill joined the crowd of children who gathered outside Richmond's elegant Ford Theater to dance for the wealthy patrons. Inside the White Zombie Theater, Richmond's upper crust enjoyed minstrel shows, a popular tradition left over from pre-war days, where white performers in blackface makeup imitated the songs and dances of plantation slaves.
In the minstrel shows, as opposed to giving blacks the opportunity to play those roles, the roles actually went to white people. What they did was to pee this makeup and put it on white faces and hands to make the white entertainers appear as if they were blacks.
Every time a new minstrel show came into town, they used to announce it by parading down the main street of the town, which happened to be Broad Street in Richmond, Virginia.
Bill learned to imitate the parading minstrel performers, and he gained a reputation on the streets as a skillful dancer. He also had a reputation for swiping food from the local merchants, which earned him the nickname Bojangles.
Bojangles was a southern term for mischief maker, which was more than appropriate for Bo at that time.
Penniless, unable to read or write his own name, at the age of 12, Bill hopped a freight train to Washington, D.C. to seek his fortune. There, he found a job as a stable boy at Denning's Racetrack and considered becoming a jockey, one of the few lucrative professions open to blacks. When he learned more about betting on the horses than about riding them. Having failed to launch a career at the racetrack, Bill returned to street dancing and soon landed his first paying job in show business, playing a pickaninny in a musical show called The South Before the War.
A pickaninny was a young black child who had to sing, dance, and look cute up on stage. A lot of people later on looked at this as a demeaning situation, but if it was the only way to get involved in show business and get an education, some people took the opportunity.
In those days, they had slavery scenes, and they had the little black kids sitting around with the bandanas on their heads, and they're doing the dance, they're doing the shuffle and the sand dance. They were all pickaninnies.
Bill traveled with the show for several years, but when he grew too old for the role of a pickaninny, he ended up back on the streets. The teenager lived from hand to mouth, dancing in beer halls and honky-tonks, any place that would have him. By the time he was 19, he was old enough to join the Spanish-American War as a drummer in a black regiment. After the war, the 22-year-old made his way to the bustling metropolis of New York City, which was growing busier and more exciting every day. Immigrants from all over the world poured into the urban Mecca in search of the American dream. It was the turn of the century, and New York was emerging as the center of the nation's arts, commerce, and entertainment. Bill was able to make a name for himself dancing in Manhattan's clubs, music halls, and small vaudeville theaters. He soon caught the attention of George W. Cooper, a successful black comedian who invited Bojangles to go on the road with him as his new partner.
George Cooper was phenomenal for Bo at that point. Cooper was an incredibly talented straight man, and he taught Bo comedy, and that was an important part of Bo's future. And he taught him professionalism.
Working with Cooper meant a steady paycheck for Bill and a chance to play the most prestigious theaters in vaudeville, traveling with the song and dance act 52 weeks a year.
Vaudeville was a very interesting type of entertainment. They didn't have the big bands or the chorus lines. It just had acts, very good acts.
The most famous theaters in vaudeville were on the Keith and Orpheum circuits. However, these circuits were also predominantly white. Only a handful of black performers like Williams and Walker and Cooper and Robinson found success there. treated as second-class citizens. They were placed under a number of restrictions, including the two-colored rule.
The two-colored rule meant that you could not perform alone on stage as a black performer. The white theater owners would say that it took two black heads in order to have enough sense to entertain a white audience, which was, of course, ridiculous to say, but those were the rules that he was working under.
Robert Lee started out playing the clown to Cooper's straight man, but by the time Bill was 30, the act had evolved to highlight his dancing, which by now was the most popular part of their act. While Bill was a consummate professional on stage, his offstage behavior was another story. Never a smoker or a drinker, Bill had only one weakness, gambling. His obsession was so great that he would sometimes gamble away the weekly paycheck before Cooper ever saw it.
Oh, he was a gambler. Bill bet on the racetracks, bet on the horses, but his big thing was pool. He'd go to any town and look up the best pool player. He got beat a lot.
In 1914, after 12 successful years, Cooper and Robinson ended their partnership. And for the first time since 1902, Bill was on his own. Finding another partner would be difficult. And the 36-year-old dancer longed to have his own solo act. He set his sights on breaking the two-colored rule and approached a successful agent named Martin Porkins for help. Porkins admired his bold ambition, and he devised a plan to make Bill the first solo black dancer in vaudeville.
Mike Porkins was very aggressive in trying to make things happen for him, and I don't think there were a lot of people who had managers who believed in him so much.
In 1916, Bill made history by performing without a partner at Chicago's Marigold Gardens Theater. Through sheer determination and talent, Bill Robinson had broken down vaudeville's color barrier. But he could never have imagined the heights to which his fame would soon soar. The world was getting to know and love Bill Beauchamp Robinson. His dancing was winning him a place among America's top vaudeville entertainers. But he still had many doors to open and many barriers to cross. The year was 1916. President Woodrow Wilson was struggling to keep the country out of war, and Americans were enjoying their last moments of peace. Theater goers across the country welcomed the lighthearted comic style of Bill Robinson, who by now was being billed as the dark cloud of joy.
Bill Robinson would talk while he was dancing, and he would say, you know, I'm going to do a step for you now that I made up, you know, when I danced for the King of Sweden. And then he said, you know, watch out, here it comes, here it is. And it was like the height of entertainment.
Working the vaudeville circuit meant constant travel. Never having known the comforts of a real home, Bill loved life on the road. But for a black performer, traveling from town to town meant dealing with racism every day.
Even though he had reached such stature as a performer, Bo was never allowed to eat in most places and would have to find meals in kitchens and could never stay at the hotels, even though he could very well afford to go to the top hotel of any city he was playing in.
Racism in America was escalating. D.W. Griffith glorified the Ku Klux Klan in his epic film, The Birth of a Nation. Lynchings in the South were on the rise. And with America now at war, black soldiers found they were treated better abroad than in their own country. By 1920, membership in the Ku Klux Klan soared to 4 million. Bill had learned long ago that segregation and racism were facts of life. However, he would not tolerate injustice. Whatever the cost, even if it meant a fight, Bill stood up for his rights.
He had an attitude. Bill had an attitude that he didn't want anybody to walk over him, and they didn't.
He was, more than anything else, someone who is willing to fight for self-respect and put his own neck on the line in order to do so, and he did so many times.
Millie was accustomed to taking care of himself. Although there were rumors of a failed marriage in his past, he was known for his fiercely independent spirit. But in 1921, at the age of 43, he surprised everyone by marrying an ambitious young drugstore clerk named Fanny Clay.
Fanny Clay was a remarkable young woman who was attending the Chicago School of Pharmacy. For a woman to go on for advanced education in those days was extremely rare. For a black woman to go on for advanced education was almost unheard of.
She loved that man more than she loved herself. Not only that, but she was his business manager and whatnot, so she saved his money. Sometimes she acted like she was his mother. She was so protective of him.
In the shadow of Manhattan's towering skyscrapers lies black, sprawling Harlem, greatest Negro metropolis in the world. Bill and Fanny made their home in Harlem, the new center of America's black culture and the home of New York's most dazzling nightlife. It was the roaring 20s, a time of prosperity, extravagance, and hedonism, and all could be found in abundance in Harlem. White New Yorkers came in droves to Harlem's Prohibition nightclubs to drink bootleg whiskey and be entertained by exotic black musicians and chorus girls.
The Cotton Club was a first-class club. It had beautiful dancing girls, beautiful show girls, the best orchestras. And every so often you could think from Broadway and Hollywood, they were there. It was wonderful. Everything was first rate. Everything was glamorous. Even the chorus girls were glamorous. When they left, they had minks on. They had mink stoles. They had foxes. The girls were sharp.
Even more exciting was a new artistic and intellectual movement known as the Harlem Renaissance.
It's the beginning of a period of the flowering of the art, the rebirth of black talent, all in one place. You can imagine Harlem with Duke Ellington, Langston Hughes, Paul Robeson, all these people living in this place. It was glamour. It was glamour and it was fashion and it was music and dance and poetry and art in all its form. It's like a camera in Harlem. Everything was just swinging. Everything.
Bill and Fanny were part of a new black upper class that joined in the celebration of Harlem's golden age.
He loved Harlem. Harlem was a place where he could be who he wanted to be. It was a place where he felt at home and people knew him and people appreciated him. It was his town. And he owned the place.
By the mid-1920s, the popularity of Harlem's all-black shows had spread downtown to Broadway. Stars like Yubi Blay, Ethel Waters, and Florence Mills were making a name for themselves on the legitimate stage. Bill Robinson made his Broadway debut in an extravagant all-black musical entitled Lou Leslie's Blackbirds of 1928.
Lou Leslie would always get the best talent for his shows. Naturally, Bill Robinson, Ballet Hall were the two great stars. And they had such great songs, like I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Dee-dee-dee-dee-doo, Doing the Blue Go Down.
Blackbirds was a smash hit, and at the age of 50, Bill Bojangles Robinson had truly hit the big time. Recognized as one of Broadway and Vaudeville's top performers, Bill was now able to command as much as $3,000 a week, making him the highest-paid black entertainer in the world. On October 29, 1929, the stock market crashed, and the roaring 20s came to an abrupt halt. Harlem was hit hard by the Depression, and its exotic nightclubs now stood alongside soup kitchens and bread lines. Although Bill still made top dollar entertaining New York's elite, he was painfully aware of the suffering of those around him.
Uncle Bo could not stand to see anybody, I don't care who you were, without, on any level. On any level, he just couldn't stand to see it. I think the thing was that he, having had to live the way he did as a youngster, never wanted anybody else to live that way. And for that reason, you could be 90 years old and you were out of luck and you were having a rough time. Uncle Bo had to take care of you.
He would find families dispossessed on the streets of Harlem, pay their back rents, and they give some money to some guys on the street to have furniture moved back in.
At a time when many gave into desperation, Bill Robinson's generosity made him a hero to the people of Harlem, and they named him their honorary mayor.
He had a special badge that he wore from the police department, and they gave him a special type of pistol that was gold with a pearl handle. And so if he saw anyone doing something wrong, he could arrest them because he had that authority.
Bill poured all of his extra time and energy into benefit performances for charities, both as an entertainer and as a producer.
They called him the benefit king. He would always do these charity shows. You just called him and he'd go there. And he did more benefits than anybody else. These children are homeless or whatever it might be. He was there to raise money for these people. He was wonderful.
By 1930, Bill Robinson was one of the best loved celebrities in New York. And on the other side of the country, Hollywood was beginning to take notice.
And that was their bonding together.
was a box office smash, and Bill was immediately signed to a four-picture deal at Fox. His first film on his new contract was In Old Kentucky, with America's favorite grown-up star, Will Rogers.
World War II.
the country's top stars focused their energy on the war effort. Bill joined in with unfailing enthusiasm, performing in countless bond rallies.
I remember Danny Kaye being quoted as saying that Bill Robinson once took off his shoes for a night in a benefit performance and sold the shoes for $10,000 for the war effort.
As the 64-year-old dancer tirelessly continued with his full schedule of shows and benefits, his wife, Fanny, grew worried about his health. Noticing his chest pains and shortness of breath, she begged him to slow down. But Bill ignored her concerns and seized every opportunity to work. In 1943, as President Roosevelt began a push for wider employment of black Americans, he urged Hollywood studios to hire more black actors. 20th Century Fox responded with Stormy Weather, a big-budget all-black musical with a star-studded cast headed by Bill Bojangles Robinson. Joining Bill in this lavish extravaganza were music legends Cab Calloway and Fats Waller. His romantic interest in the film was a 26-year-old singer named Lena Horne. Stormy Weather also featured two of Bill's favorite honorary nephews, the Nicholas Brothers, and a show-stopping dance number.
I remember when we were getting ready to do our number, and he saw these big stairs that they had built for us to jump over each other's heads into space. And he said, "Are you really going to do that?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, good luck."
Stormy Weather was a major milestone for blacks in Hollywood, and it was a personal milestone for Bill. Not only was he playing the leading character in a Hollywood film, he was finally given the opportunity to act and dress like the successful performer that he was.
Baby, tell that lucky day, you know darn well. Baby, I can't give you anything but love.
In the movie stuff, that was the thing that separated him, that made everybody so proud of him. He was a real movie star.
That was still very much segregated, Bill Robinson had transcended racial boundaries in both his career and his personal life. His diverse group of close friends and colleagues included Jackie Robinson, Fred Astaire, Ed Sullivan, Joe Louis, and Milton Berle.
He had many, many friends, all different nationalities, races, and they all loved him. Because of his personality, he had a great personality on stage and off stage.
Bill returned to the stage and Born Happy. But when he began spending too much time with a shy young chorus girl named Elaine Plains, his wife Fanny asked for a divorce. In June of 1943, the couple ended the 21-year marriage.
Bo was aging at this point, and Bo had a bad heart. Fanny wanted to stop dancing to live longer. This is something that Bill Robinson would not listen to. And that, more than anything else, was one of the major causes of the divorce. She couldn't live with him and watch him in pain, and he couldn't live without dancing.
On January 27th, 1944, at age 65, Bill married the 24-year-old Elaine. As always, Bill flaunted convention and continued to live the life he wanted to lead, defying his age and his health. 1945, Bill Robinson was 67 and enjoying his status as a legendary figure in the entertainment world. He was also enjoying domestic life, embracing his new wife's family as his own.
What he got in his old age is security within a family environment. He became the head figure of a family with brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, and they would play cards with him, and they would have fun with him, and he loved that part of it.
But Bill wasn't about to retire. In 1945, he starred in yet another Broadway show, Memphis Bound, an all-black version of Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore. He also continued to perform in as many benefits as he could fit into his schedule. By this time, he had danced in over 3,000 shows for charity.
He was generous to a fault. He was a very, very generous person, and I think he enjoyed his celebrity, and he enjoyed what his celebrity enabled him to do to help other people.
At age 68, Bill's health was seriously deteriorating, but he insisted on taking another show on the road, the Bill Robinson Concert Review. His longtime manager, Marty Forkins, gave up all of his other clients in order to go on one last tour with his dearest friend, with whom he had shared so many battles and triumphs.
God bless Mr. Forkins. He was right there. He really treated Uncle Bo as though he was a blood relative instead of just a client. He protected him all the way down the line.
Bill's family grew alarmed as his heart began to fail him. But despite doctors' warnings, he refused to slow down. On November 14th, 1949, Bill had a massive heart attack. For days, an anxious public listened to frequent radio bulletins on his condition as he lay in the hospital. On November 25th, Bill Robinson died at the age of 71. As his fans across the country mourned the loss of a national treasure, the people of New York joined in a tearful farewell to the man who had brought them so much joy.
There has never been, and I doubt there will ever be, another funeral like that. You saw people lining both sides of the street and the park and the freeway. He didn't have a mother, he didn't have a father, but nobody in this world has ever been grieved for as he. Kings and queens haven't done that. And you never saw so many grown men with tears coming down and reaching back to get their handkerchiefs.
It was the largest funeral in New York's city history. Over 1.5 million people lined the streets from Harlem to Brooklyn. His body lay in state at the Armory up in Harlem because it was large enough to hold crowds. It was an outpouring of love.
He was so generous to New York City and so revered. He was a dignitary. His death been lined up. It was huge. It wasn't just New Yorkers. I mean, people came from all over the world to mourn his passing.
Having spent, gambled, or given away his fortune, Bill died virtually penniless. Friends and colleagues raised the needed funds for his elaborate funeral. Ed Sullivan coordinated the ceremony, and honorary pallbearers included Duke Ellington, Joe Louis, Bob Hope, Jackie Robinson, Joe DiMaggio, and Irving Berlin. In his eulogy, the Reverend Alan Clayton Powell Jr. said, "Bill wasn't a credit to his race, meaning the Negro race. Bill was a credit to the human race. He was not a great Negro dancer. He was the world's greatest dancer."
Bill was so revered by everyone. Bill had both white and black people who were in awe of him. Everybody loved Bill Robinson.
All of us who have come behind Bill Robinson owe him a debt of appreciation. Because as I sat in the movie theater watching him dance, I could also see the Little Rock riots and how they didn't want people like me to come to a school to see him. It made me feel like it was possible that I could do that.
I don't think that would be another person like him. And I miss him very much. Because he was my favorite. He was in the class all by himself. There's only one Bill Robinson.
Yeah, I'd like to see you looking so well, baby. Diamond bracelets worth a dozen sales, baby. Tell that lucky day, you know darn well, baby. I can't give you anything but love.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you just heard another presentation by the great, or by Ozzie Davis, who's no longer with us. Ozzie was a great movie star, he and his wife, but he gave a tremendous presentation on Bill Joe Bojangles Robinson, who I heard my mother and father talk about when I was a little child. I didn't know him, or I never saw him, except later on I saw a movie he did with Shirley Temple, who at that particular time was a grown woman. This should tell you a little bit about what black people had to go through way back then in the day, between, like, he was born in 1878 and died in 1949. 71 years of age today would be something like 61 today. We just have to think back to that institution that this man won over, and the way he was able to capture it with a person who couldn't read, couldn't write. He couldn't even sign his own name. I remember my mother telling me something about him, the way he signed his name with an X, and he was able to make a little, on one of the X's, make a U-turn, like a right for Robinson. And that's very, very interesting. So listen, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm going to do right now is tell you about some of the other shows that we're going to have that will be coming up this coming Friday. I plan on doing one on, which is narrated by Richard Roundtree. It's a portrait of Pam Grier, who was a great movie star. We're going to be doing a little documentation on her. And then we're going to go on to the next show. Will be done, The Heritage of Slavery by Fannie Lou Hamer. And then following week, we're going to do something on Ray Charles, a 60-minute presentation on him. And then the final show that I figured out that we're going to do would be on the great Nat King Cole. And so those are the shows that we're going to do, and we're going to be looking at each one of those shows in terms of how they represented a certain institution and what they did to cause sort of a problem with history in terms of the institution. For example, in Nat King Cole's situation, here's a man who I think was discovered by a gentleman by the name of Arthur Garfrey, who had a radio show in the 1940s, or I think early 40s. Nat King Cole was actually playing a piano. That was the instrument he played, and he was really a very fantastic piano player, which you'll find out when you hear the documentation about him. but Nat was not known at that particular time as a singer. He had a little trio, and it played down in St. Louis. But he was discovered by Arthur Godfrey and played on the Arthur Godfrey show, Get Your Kicks on Route 66, I think was one of his biggest hits back then in the early 40s, right after the Second World War. And then, of course, he went on to do such a tremendous number of hits, one right after the next. Went on later on to have his own television show, and that was a downfall. He could not, even though he had some fantastic entertainers like Billy Eckstine and Lena Horne and a whole troop of black entertainers as well as white entertainers on the show, he couldn't find anybody to sponsor his show. So the show did only last about a year and maybe half, if that. So that will give you an indication of that particular institution, how they starved black entertainers from being successful. Ray Charles, when he first came about, on the other hand, in that same mode, he came around just later on after Nat King Cole and tried to imitate Nat King Cole and was unsuccessful until he started singing like he sang. He was the true person that really exhibited a soulful kind of approach. Very successful because the man was blind and at the same time was a genius. Now, a lot of people don't understand that Ray Charles did more than just play a piano. He could write music as well as arrange music, and on top of that, played a heck of a saxophone. Well, you'll hear about all these particular things. But I thought I wanted to let you know what was going to come. Then we're gonna do that show on the heritage of slavery and Fannie Mae Lou Hamer, and I am not going to tell you about that. I'm going to let you figure it out when it happens. And finally, we're going to do on Pam Grier, who was a female actress. I thought maybe I was going to do Diane Carroll because she recently passed away, and I wanted to do her. But I, you know, like when you're doing some things, there are just so many of them. I had thought about doing Frankie Lyman, you know, the teenagers. Way when I was growing up, Frankie Lyman was one of the rock and roll groups that a lot of guys was hanging on the streets, and we had to do the doo-wop and doo-wop kind of thing. And I remember singing with a group called the Pastels, and later on a group called the Connoisseurs. And one of the reasons why we were able to do the things that we did was because of Frankie Lyman. As a matter of fact, I got an opportunity at the Buckingham Hall in Waterbury, Connecticut to meet Frankie Lyman. It wasn't a really meet. I mean, it was, hello, hi, how are you? And he went and sang. That particular time, he was not singing with the teenagers any longer. He was singing a song called Goody Goody, and he's singing it by himself. And he was booked in Waterbury, Connecticut, of all places, to perform. I had thought very seriously of doing something because of the way he was projected, and that is the great Booker T. Washington, who wrote the book Up From Slavery, and which was read by Ozzie Davis, and then I want to do something on Ozzie Davis. But, you know, you there's only so much that you can do, and there's only my situation is that it's hard to select all of the various people that you feel that you want to do something, because I wanted to do something with Dr. John Henrik Clark versus Mary Lewinsky. That was called The Great Debate. I had started with something on that, but I had to back up off of it because these other things start popping up in my head. And, you know, when you have things that are happening in your head and you have very few people who can talk about it, because when I finish with my show, I look up all the various comments that people make about the show. So take time to send off messages to all these people who are kind enough to either call me on the phone or to text me on my email And by the way, my email address is docdean1212@gmail.com. And if you would like to be a guest on the show where we would sit down and discuss various elements of the things that are happening either today or in the future that you can project, or things that happened in the past, depending on how old you are and how far you can go back. I would love to talk to some older persons. I can remember talking to a young lady out in, she wasn't a young lady. When I was talking to her, she was 98 years old. And she went back to school when she was 87 years old and a graduate from college out in Springfield, Illinois. And eventually went on to teach school until she was 98 years old. Was written a letter by, showed me the letter. She showed me the letter that Ronald Reagan wrote to her to thank her for her extreme diligence and upward of mobility, I guess he said. I can't remember precisely what it was, what was stated. Well, you've been listening to Getting It Done, and I think today we got some of the things done that I wanted to do with the great presentation by Ozzie Davis on the life and times of Bill Bojangles Robinson, who in one of the Sammy Davis Jr. songs, he talks about Joe Bojangles, and he sings in that song about how he lightly stepped down. But hopefully you've enjoyed what was presented, and if hopefully my comments didn't turn you off, but hopefully turned you on, because we will continue with the discussions of things, and we don't have to wait until February to talk about black entertainers. This is Dr. Walter Dean signing off, and hopefully you will tune in again on Friday at 4:30. We will go from 4:30 to 6 on this coming Friday. And if you check out your computer, you will see exactly the kind of thing that we will be discussing. So until then, I don't have to stay for the whole last 3 minutes because I just think I'm going to be wearing out my welcome. But I appreciated you, as well as I can see the number of people who have had the opportunity to listen to the show, and I appreciate you listening. Have a good week, and I look forward to seeing you in, or hearing you or watching you or listening to you in the future. Thank you. Bye-bye.